The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
My wife and I felt called to start the church in Asheville, North Carolina. So anybody from west of here, getting close to Asheville, a few people? Good, yeah. So we planted right in the middle of downtown Asheville. And so that was a bit of a culture shock. So if you've ever been there. Yeah, in case you've never been to Asheville, there are stereotypes about Asheville, and there are stereotypes for a reason, because they're basically all true. So it is the hole in the Bible Belt, so it's like one of the blue dots in the southeast, and they call it the cesspool of sin, so dive right in, and they're kind of proud about that. So it's kind of like an Austin, Texas, or a Portland, Oregon type feel, or a Boulder, Colorado. In fact, people would make that circuit. They'd move from Austin up to Asheville, and then to Boulder, and then to Portland, and keep on making that circle. And so that's where we planted the church, and it's a really, really different environment. And so we had to adjust personally as well as ministry-wise. I remember the first time in Asheville where we were at a fundraiser for a nonprofit, Pisgah Legal. It's a legal service that provides pro bono legal stuff, and there were lots of people just hanging out and enjoying hors d'oeuvres, and they asked what I did, and I said I was a pastor. They said, what kind of church? I said, you know, it's a Baptist, it's an evangelical church, and like three guys just took their plates and walked away and didn't talk to me the rest of the day. So I remember the first time that happened, I'm like, well, this doesn't happen in Charlotte, this doesn't happen in Raleigh, but it does happen often in Asheville. And so it was very, very, very different. Our daughters, they went to school in downtown Asheville. None of their friends went to church or had ever been to church. Many went to the Universal Unitarian Church, but where we met one believer, a single mom of one of our kids' friends that was a believer. And so ministry was just completely different up there. I actually saw Steve Harris was here. He's leading a track with Malia right now. But he'll tell you, in Asheville, there's no territorialism when it comes to pastors. So when they hear a new church plant's coming to town, they're not like angry. They're like, yes, please stay. Please come to downtown. We need all the help that we can get. And so sheep swapping really isn't an issue. You're not going to attract a whole lot of people from churches. And so I just came face to face with a different mindset. In my past church experience in Charlotte and in Raleigh, a good majority of the people that were coming to faith were people that were that grew up in church and walked away from the church and now were coming back to the church, be that Roman Catholic or evangelical or Baptist. Not that Baptists or evangelical are different, but you get me. But in Asheville, these were people that had never, ever, ever been to church. So we launched our church in September of 2015, and we used a community charter school there right across from UNC Asheville, right across the street there. And it was holistic learning school. It was really a Buddhist school. So they had all these posters of the different colors your chakra could be and what that meant. And so we're like, I guess pipe and drape, we can put that up for church. But we would have people, they had a percussion room in the basement. So during some of the services, you'd hear these drum circles going on. And we'd have people with dreadlocks come in and check it out. And they would walk in and they would see chairs set up. They'd see two side screens. They'd see a music stand. They'd see an acoustic guitar. They'd see slides, like these announcement slides, rolling on the side. They'd be like, what is this place? Because they had never been in a church in their entire life. We're like, it's a church. What kind of a church? Like, you have guitars and stuff, and what is this place? So it was just a completely different mindset. So on any given day, we eventually moved right into the downtown area. On any given day, I would walk the streets and just talk with people and try to be a minister to that neighborhood. So I would talk to lots and lots of homeless people. Asheville's very kind to homeless people and treats them well, and you'll very rarely go without a meal. And because of that, a lot of people that are down and out flock to the city. And so I'd meet with homeless people. There's another group called Travelers. They're purposely homeless, and they just have a different style of clothing, and they have the dogs usually. They usually have pit bulls with them. So that's the Travelers. They move through in the summer on their way to like Denver or Florida or stuff. So I talked to them. I talked to prostitutes on the street. We're on the South French Broad area of Asheville. I talked to the pimps of the prostitutes. I would talk to self-professed witches and warlocks. And Asheville used to be the Wicca capital of the U.S., so Wiccan kind of paganism. They say there's more Wiccans in the woods in Asheville than bunnies. And it's true. There's lots and lots of self-professed pagans and Wiccans and witches and warlocks and stuff. And then I'd also talk to successful liberal, progressive business owners. We called them halfbacks, people from up north that moved to Florida and it was too hot, so they came halfway back to Asheville. So I talked to them, but very rarely would I ever talk to a Christian. So this was a completely brand new experience for me. I was born in Union County in Charlotte, so this was just completely different for me. But that's where I've lived, and that's where I've done ministry for the last 5 years. Recently, we handed over leadership of that church, which is still going strong, to actually a pastor from Summit. And so he's taken over. I'm back at my church in Raleigh, overseeing. We're doing 7 new campuses in the next 7 years. So I've been tasked with kind of overseeing that. So even in the new job that I'm at, I'm still thinking about the mind of the people that have not yet come. So my job really is to kind of understand unbelievers and try to make the gospel available to them. And I'm convinced that if every one of us in this room puts in the work of actually trying to understand the mindset of unbelievers, then it'll really help us make the gospel available. So that's kind of the question that I want to answer is, how should we think about ministry or go about ministry in this new secular environment that we find ourselves in? Now, I know some of you may be thinking, you know, we're from like Mebane or we're from Smithfield. Like this is not Asheville. This is not Chapel Hill. But what I think you'll find at the end of this is the new secularism, the secular culture that we live in, it's not just reserved for like Berkeley and for like Boston. Like it is seeped into every single area of our culture due to technology and YouTube and Netflix and all that sort of stuff. And so what I can't do is I can't give you like one book or one methodology or one system that will absolutely 100% reach all the secular people in your area, but we can have a good conversation about it. So first, I want to give you a resource list. So I just want to recommend 5 books. So if you're taking notes, yes. How many of you have, you're at like a conference that's dealing with apologetics. So you guys have kind of read Francis Schaeffer probably, Schaeffer Institute, How Now Shall We Live, that sort of stuff. So you're familiar with that. There's a new wave of apologetics and philosophers and people like Francis Schaeffer that have kind of come onto the scene in the past 20, 25 years that now kind of your modern everyday pastor is just now hearing about. And so kind of the man, like the Francis Schaeffer of this generation is a guy named Charles Taylor. He is a Canadian Roman Catholic philosopher. And he wrote a book called A Secular Age. So write down Charles Taylor, A Secular Age. That is the book and has been the book for the past 10 years. He really put his pulse on the new world that we live in. Francis Schaeffer stuff is still really good, but Francis Schaeffer is describing a world that does not exist anymore. He's describing kind of the late 70s, early 80s. Now that we're in like 2019, the world's changed a lot. Charles Taylor's the one who kind of has a pulse on that. I will warn you, I would actually recommend not reading this book because it's 900 pages. It is $55, and it is the magnum opus of a world-class philosopher. Your brain will start to hemorrhage in like 15 pages, okay? But if that's your thing, if you like hard books and you like, I mean, like you're like, yeah, I read Jonathan Edwards and the Puritans. This guy's like 10 steps harder, all right? It's a really hard book, but if that's your deal, then go and get that. The book that I would recommend everyone gets, it's called How Not to Be Secular. It's by an author named James K.A. Smith. James K.A. Smith teaches a class on Charles Taylor at Calvin College, and he compiled all of his class notes into a book called How Not to Be Secular. So it's an introduction and a summary of This Secular World by Charles Taylor. So I it's an amazing book. I took my staff through it, my church plant staff in Asheville. It's still really tough, but it's only about 125, 130 pages. I reread it the past 2 days just in preparation for this. You could easily read it in the course of a day, but you won't actually be able to understand everything that you read. So I would recommend setting aside a month to go through it. That's the best one, okay? That's written towards kind of Christian ministers. Third one, Tim Keller came out with a new book called Making Sense of God. Have you heard of that? Okay, once you read Taylor or you read James K.A. Smith, you'll be like, oh, Keller is using Charles Taylor too. And what Keller does is he took all of Charles Taylor's thoughts, and instead of writing a book addressed to Christians, he wrote a book addressed to non-Christians. based on Charles Taylor thought. But that's a great book as well. And then there's another guy named Mark Sayers, M-A-R-K-S-A-Y-E-R-S. You ever heard of The Disappearing Church? That's a new book that's kind of been out. He's Australian. He's kind of artsy. I don't necessarily agree with every single conclusion that he comes with, but he does a really good job of kind of giving us the feel of what church might be like in this new secular world. He's got some great podcasts and sermons as well. And then lastly, there's another book called Our Secular Age, 10 Years of Reading and Applying Charles Taylor. And some of you are like, who is this Charles Taylor guy? This is put out by the Gospel Coalition. So it's a compilation of essays by the Gospel Coalition of famous pastors that have been working with and thinking through these things once Charles Taylor's book came out for the past 10 years. And so there's kind of conclusions there, some correctives, and just some overall wisdom about this stuff. So as you can tell, this dude's a big deal. So that's kind of my recommended reading list. Start with How Not to Be Secular, and then I'd probably go with Keller, something by Mark Sayers and stuff. But if you want a good summer project, At Secular Age by Taylor's great. So what is this new age that Taylor calls a secular age that we all live in? So how would I summarize this new secular world that we live in 10 minutes? Well, it took Taylor 955 pages, so this is going to be hard for me. But if I were to summarize Taylor and kind of summarize what I experienced in Asheville, it would be three things, okay? Three things. And I just want to tell you, too, this is not... the way Taylor describes it is he describes the feel of our world. This is what it feels like to live in the world. And this is the world that most people now take for granted. So this isn't a carefully crafted logical system. This is not a philosophy. There's no one sitting down and saying, we are of the secular thought world and we want to try to convert more people to... No, this is just the way things are and the way it feels. So the first is imminent. So everyone say imminent. And it's with an I, it's not with an E. So there's a quote by Nietzsche. What's Nietzsche's famous quote? God is dead. That's never been more true than in our secular age, the world that we live in. Taylor does a really good job of explaining how we got from transcendence, where everything was divine and we had all these spirits, to where there is no divine, there is no religion, there is no God anymore. But we don't have time to get into all that. But basically, there's no more transcendence. So Schaeffer, kind of the secular sacred divide, we've taken the attic out, right? We just live in the basement. So we live in this imminent frame. It's just humans. It's just the natural world. There is no God. It's just us. That's kind of the basis of our secular world. There's nothing outside of the physical world. In the old days, Taylor says, we were porous, which means we had holes through us. So as we walk throughout life, like evil spirits could get in and influence us. Or good spirits could kind of get in. That's why we had like relics and holy objects. Like if you hold a cross up, that's a good object, and it would go take away bad spirits. So back in the old days, it was almost unthinkable to not believe in God. Number one, because an evil spirit might start attacking you, and God's not going to come to your rescue because he's angry at you. And then number two, if the community that you lived in heard that you didn't believe in God, they would burn you at the stake because all the cows would die or the plague would occur. So back in the old days, it was unthinkable to not believe in God. But nowadays, Taylor calls it the buffered self. It's just us. There's no outside influence. He would say that now we've gone from transcendence to absolute imminence. In our world, it is almost an impossibility to believe in a God. And when I say our, you know, I'm like acting like I'm a part of this world, okay? This is not my beliefs. It's perfectly fine not to believe in God. In fact, that is the default belief. And so hear that this morning. So for the people that you are trying to reach in your city, the fact that they don't believe in God is normal. None of their friends believe in God. Their cousins do not believe in God. Their aunts and uncles don't believe in God. They might go to church, but they don't functionally state they believe in God, and they certainly don't live like it. This is the default normal belief. This is where it's changed from 20 years ago. 20 years ago, if you didn't believe in God, you might be doing it just to get attention, right? You want to be that cool kind of like, kind of dangerous atheist, right? And kind of ruffle feathers and stuff. Not the case anymore. It's just the default position. Their mom is not trying them to get to go to church. Their wife isn't nagging them to read the Bible. The most sensible way of living in this secular world is completely without God. So that's where people are starting when they come into our church. Early on in Asheville, man, I had so many gospel conversations, people on the street or from the pulpit. And the way that I was presenting the gospel is the gospel is the solution to the guilt that you and I feel before a holy God, right? We're guilty, we're sinful. Don't you want to be rid of that guilt? And what I realized is I was offering a solution to a problem that no one had. No one felt guilty before a holy God because God didn't exist. And even if God did exist, they were pretty sure God would be happy with them. They lived a really good life. So I was offering them an answer to a question they weren't asking. Now, is Jesus the solution to guilt before a holy God? Absolutely. And that's important, and we need to get there, but that's not where I would recommend starting. Because the default position, people don't even have God in their minds. So that's the first one, is that imminence. Now, here's where it's going to start to get interesting. Number two, I kind of cheated. I put like two things together in option two and three. So it's really five things. But number two, cross, pressured, and fragile. Everyone say cross, pressured, and fragile. Okay, here's what I mean by this. You might think from growing up, going to like apologetics classes or reading apologetics books and stuff, that the world nowadays is kind of just two groups of people. There's Christians or there's non-Christians. Growing up, that's what I thought. There's just Christians, there's non-Christians. And then, how many of you have taken an apologetics class before or read an apologetics book? What thought system do most of those apologetics books defend against? Usually, 99% of the time, an apologetics course or a book is defending Christianity against the scientifically informed atheism, right? So we have the Jesus Fish bumper sticker, and we have the Darwin bumper sticker. That's what I grew up. I got to defend my faith against people that believe in evolution, that don't believe in creation, all this sort of stuff. Big Bang, universal flood, all that sort of stuff. And 20, 30 years ago, that was kind of the major thing that Christianity needed to defend against. There was only like one real enemy. It was evolution. So there were really two options: evolution, creation, God or no God, science or faith. But that's not the world that we live in anymore. So when I moved to Asheville, in 5 years, I saw one Darwin bumper sticker. That's the only one. But what bumper sticker did I see a lot? Coexist. You know it. Yes, coexist. I did not meet one person in Asheville who did not believe in God because of science. Never did I hear that. And that surprised me. And I was kind of angry because I spent money on books and prepping myself to defend against that. But no, the world has changed. My apologetics didn't do any good. And so what's happened, Taylor explains this, in the past 30 years, there's been this pressure between like theism and atheism, between like evolution and creation, between immanence and transcendence. And there's been this pressure building. And then with that pressure, you add in globalism and consumerism and technology. And what's happened is what Taylor calls a nova. But you know when a star kind of collapses in on itself and then it explodes? That's what's happened in our culture. These two things have been pressing and pressing and pressing and pressing. And the pressure's gotten too much. And we've exploded into not two options, but 2,000 or 2 million or 2 billion different options. So no longer do we live in a world where either there is a God or there's not. No. Maybe there's different gods. Maybe there's half gods or half not gods. So there's 2,000 different options. This is what Taylor calls the Nova effect. And we're pressured to research and experiment and figure out which of the 2,000 ways is best. Maybe it's not even one of the 2,000 different options that we have. Maybe we have to create a 2,001st option for ourselves by borrowing and mixing from those 2,000s. And you feel this. How many of you are grandparents in here? Okay, better yet, any great grandparents in here? Yes, okay. So you obviously have children. When you bought a stroller for your children, your first child, what was the process like? Probably went to Sears and bought one, right? Okay, yeah, you just went into the store and you bought a stroller. Now, yeah, there's just one kind. Any new parents in here? Okay, think back to your first child. Not your second or third, because we don't care as much. Your first child. What was the process of buying a stroller like? Yeah, Consumer Reports, research. There's jogging strollers, there's umbrella strollers, there's sit-and-stand strollers, there's double jogging strollers, there's double sit-and-stand jogging strollers, there's double side-by-side sit-and-stand with the optional third-part thing. And then if you want the infant car system, you have to figure out which works inside. Yeah, so there's 1,000 different Amazon options, and you probably search for no less than a month on just a stinking stroller. It's like there's a decision paralysis, and that's the world that we live in today. So there's not just one option. That's what he means by cross-pressured. There's all these thousands of different options. Because there is no God, and we still desperately need things like meaning and purpose and satisfaction, it's up to us to find that, but there's just so many darn options. And it's almost impossible to commit to just one option. So Taylor says, everything is contestable. Rival stories are always at the door offering a different account of the world. And so we're cross-pressured by thousands of different options, and each one of these options is fragile. It could be proved wrong at any moment. We can be scrolling down, and there's that one-star Amazon review, and we're like, oh no, did I get the wrong stroller? Is this the wrong baby bottle? All that sort of stuff. So listen, most people are not diehard believers, even in your churches. They're not diehard believers or diehard unbelievers. They live in this no man's land in between. And they're not really sure where to commit because there's so many options. And you feel this. This is why transience is such a big deal in our culture. In Asheville, people would move in for a year and a half and move out. And I'm like, I was training you to be an elder. Why are you leaving? I'm training you to be an elder at someone else's church. People move into our cities and move out in 2 years because they're not sure that's the best city. Is this the best job? They can't commit. They want to keep their options open. That's why church hopping happens. This is a good church, but I don't know. Maybe I'm missing out. Maybe it's better at this church. Maybe we want to try small. Maybe we try big. Maybe we try medium. And that's why people treat kind of church membership like a gym membership nowadays, something to be added or subtracted depending on whether it helps us or not. I'm on this journey to find significance and satisfaction on my own. And if God helps, awesome. And if he doesn't, I'm gonna drop him because I gotta keep my options open. And so the actual biggest pushback to Christianity that I received in Asheville and actually now in Raleigh is how can you possibly say Christianity is 100% true? Nothing is uncontestable. Nothing is for sure. So people are willing to say, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I will not say that all these other options aren't correct. Right? We even feel that in our churches. So that's the second one. It's cross-pressured and it's fragile. And then the third one, and this was really eye-opening to me. I completely identify with that second one. But the third one is haunted and disappointed. Everyone say haunted and disappointed. Taylor says a malaise has settled in over us. Basically, now that we've been in this imminent world, taking God completely out of it, there's all this pressure to figure out all these, this best option. We've been living in this secular, imminent, cross-pressured, fragile world for a few decades. We're responding in really interested ways. The first one is that we are haunted by the transcendent. We've kicked God out, but he keeps showing up in the weirdest of places. One author writes, God is dead, but I miss him. And you'll hear this if you listen to Death Cab for Cutie, or you listen to Radiohead, or you listen to like any lyrics by like Fleet Foxes or new indie bands coming out. This is exactly the tone that you see. We've taken the divine completely out of our life, but we yearn for him to return. So there's no happy atheists anymore. I think that died, not Richard Dawkins, but who's the guy that passed away? Yes, Hitchens. Hitchens passed away. He was one of the last staunch, settled, content atheists. You don't see that anymore. We still have weddings and funerals, and where do we have them? In churches, in sacred places. We talk about art and music and poetry, and what type of language do we use? We use religious language. We've made a quick and passionate return to morality. Morality is a religious, Christian ideology that from our Judeo-Christian background. So I grew up kind of in the Clinton years. In the Clinton years, it really was tolerance. Like, you do whatever you want and no one really cares, as long as you're not hurting anyone. Now, nothing could be further from the truth, could it? Everyone cares what everyone does. And if you don't publicly say something's right or publicly say something's wrong, then you are being immoral. Moral language is just dripping from Twitter and from Facebook. It's almost a return to the prophetic language of the Old Testament. We've kicked God out, and yet we still are addicted to morality and religious language and transcendence. We tried to get rid of God or morality or the divine, but we can't get rid of them, which leads to the last point. We actually don't want to get rid of them. So we've sealed ourselves off from God. When we did that, we said we don't need God to find significance and meaning and satisfaction and purpose in life. We were sure we could get that for ourselves, but now more and more people are seeing we can't. Science has not delivered on what it's promised. Politics, obviously, has not delivered on what it has promised. And so we're actually really, really frustrated with the world that we've created. That's the overall feeling. We're sick of this modern world. We're frustrated and angry and depressed, and we have no God to shout, this is not the way it's supposed to be. This is broken. That's what we feel, and that's what we want to shout, but we can't shout it at God. So, Me Too movement, and Black Lives Matter, and Blue Lives Matter, and All Lives Matter, and gay rights, and transgender rights, and the revival of socialism and identity politics, right? It's all of us saying, this is not right. Something's broken and we need to fix it. The last place we're looking is God, though. And so we sense this secular life is unlivable, but since we took God out of the equation, we don't have a solution. We can only blame other people and other groups. And so what we're experiencing now is this malaise that Taylor talks about. It's just a settled kind of depression and frustration. And either we try really hard to fix the broken like we see in these movements, or we just try to numb ourselves and we try to pull ourselves out of the mundane. So we have Netflix, we have the opioid epidemic, we have the rise in internet pornography, we have consumer debt, we have obesity. We just have to escape and numb ourselves from these insignificant lives. So you think Taylor's onto something here? Yes. Can you identify with any of this? So when you read that book or you read James K.A. Smith, you're like, man, I know what he's talking. I feel what he's talking about. And so all of that, once again, is just taken for granted. This isn't a cleverly deduced logical system. In fact, the way we actually got here was really, really weird. It wasn't from like point A to point B. It was all these weird results and unexpected results and stuff. So what do we do with this? How can we minister to this new generation of people? Can or should we do anything differently? And I think the answer is yes. I actually think that you would probably know best how to change your ministry depending on this. But these are very, very, very practical things that I would encourage you to do and that I found was beneficial to my ministry, especially in the context of Asheville. Some of these things might not work for you in your different culture. But the first, I just have three. The first is this. In this new secular world that we find ourselves in, I think the first thing that we can do that we can change is that we can finally go on the offense. So I think for too long, we've been on the defense. And kind of the picture we've seen is you put Christians in kind of like the Roman Colosseum, and people are throwing pot shots at us from the stands because everyone's so sure and science is such a solid foundation. All that's crumbled. So we can take advantage of the doubt that people are feeling about the secular world that they live in. We can challenge the 2,000 other options out there. I think the tables have turned. People are doubting their doubt in God. And I think it's actually loving and caring for us to call that out. So I would do this more and more from the stage. Usually I would, I grew up saying the gospel is offensive. We don't want, like, nothing else should really be in church. Like, we don't want to offend you in the parking lot. Like, you're going to get offended with the gospel. So we try to create, like, a seeker-sensitive and kind of friendly atmosphere. I'm still open to that, but I would begin saying hard things from the stage and in my personal conversation. So I would say things like, aren't you sick of trying to find significance on your own? I'd say, you're trying to, I can see it. There's a reason you have that weird haircut. There's a reason you're not vaccinating your kids. There's a reason you're only eating like kale for the past 6 months. Like you are trying to do something with your life. Aren't you sick of trying to find that significance on your own? Because you were never meant to. Aren't you sick of numbing everything with wine and Netflix? For some reason, it's just expected if you are a mom and you have children under six, you're basically a functional alcoholic. You can see it all over Facebook. And it's accepted, like it's wine o'clock. That, man, women are drinking 6, 8, 10 glasses of wine every single night. You can call that out. Why do you need to numb yourself every single night? Why are you binging on Netflix? Why are you so desperately needing to escape? So the foundation that people stand on nowadays is very, very shaky. I would say go ahead and push on it and topple it and try to pull it down because it's never been this fragile before. So don't be afraid to call it like you see it. I would say often ask questions like, are you happy? Seems like you are on social media, but it doesn't seem like you are when we're in person. Are you really happy? Are you content? The speaker pointed this out at the last breakout, but I had lots of people say, Jesus is great, he's a good teacher, but just any religion that says that my gay neighbor, that's sin, I just can't agree with. And so you'll get a lot of stuff like, if it wasn't for the sexuality. So I would just ask them, what makes you think that mainly white, wealthy, Western cultures, less than 1% of the globe, have suddenly figured out sexual ethics in the past 15 or 20 years? Like, how in the world do you think that you've arrived at these solutions to sexual morality? It's just been 15, 20 years, and it's a small percentage of the population. We can ask questions like this now, and they actually lead to good conversations. Taylor actually spends the last quarter of his book taking jabs at the secular world. So the secular world says Christianity is just one take on what the world is really like, and Taylor says the irony is so is secularity. It's just one take among two thousands of options. So go on the offense in a loving way, okay? And what you'll find is you're putting words into the mouths of people that haven't been able to describe what they've been feeling, but you do it better than they can. Keller's real big on that. You should be able to explain their discrepancies with Christianity way better than they can, and then you provide an answer for it. So that's the first one. Go on the offense. The second one is this. I know I'm speaking to a Baptist crowd, all right? So this is specifically for us. With so many viable options out there for people and the absence of any sort of social stigma around different lifestyles or pursuits, the people who are going to begin trying out your church, they have ventured way farther off course than probably we did growing up, okay? So the prodigal son walking away from home, that path is a lot longer and gets into some really weird territory nowadays. So like drinking in high school and experimenting with marijuana a little bit in college and maybe kissing your girlfriend too long before you get married, like that's tame kid stuff nowadays. So we have to be willing and not shocked and actually prepared to love people where they are coming from. And they're coming from some very scary and uncomfortable and foreign places. So you as a church leader need to be prepared to love people exactly where they are, and where they are in today's world is drastically different than in the past. So are you willing? We went through this at my current church just a few months ago. We're a gay couple with three kids. We want to turn our life over to Jesus. That's complicated. Sin complicates stuff. Got to buy another house. Got to separate. Who's going to watch the kids? You have to be prepared and willing to go through that. Are you willing to do that? Are you willing to love and walk beside the person that is addicted to heroin and is slowly getting out of that addiction, or to a person who is genetically male and now has decided to follow Christ, but they have gone through surgeries to make them female, and now those are irreversible? How are they going to walk in a way that honors Christ and be a part of the body with that sort of path that they've lived? We went through a season of talking about a merger with a local church in Asheville, and they've been there for about 50 years, and they were amazing people, but many of them were very uncomfortable with the types of people that came to our church. So we had two guys follow us up from Raleigh. There were 20 of us that sold our houses and moved to start this church. And we had two guys follow us up from Raleigh, and they were a rap duo. And Noah, he's the whitest guy ever. But when he raps, you're like, man, that's crazy. He's good. But he has long hair. He was decked out in Panther gear from like head to toe. Panther socks, like Panther patch on his shoes, Panther sweatshirt, and a big gold chain, all this sort of stuff. So he ran sound for us. They didn't even believe in Jesus, but they liked us. They wanted us to help start a church. They both got saved, but they kind of felt uncomfortable about them. Often we would have homeless people that we'd wake up on our church step and bring them inside. There's multiple times where I had to go take drugs out of the church bathroom and kind of flush them or get rid of them, like that sort of stuff. We had travelers there with their dogs in service. We had a guy who liked to wear dresses. He just liked to. That was just a hobby of his. So he'd show up to church in a dress. That's it. He was straight. He had girlfriends. He just liked to wear dresses. We had a few times where amazing, very, very kind transgender from male to female came on Sundays. And every time that happened at our church, because we trained our congregation, they were like, this is amazing. This is awesome. Praise God. We want to love these people where they are. But the church we were talking about merging with, not so much. What are these people doing in church? Why are they sitting like... So you have to be prepared. This is the world that we live in. And it takes a lot of training and a lot of work of the Spirit to make this possible. Divya was a girl that came to know Jesus, and she was pagan. And so after she came to know Jesus, a few of our members had to go into her house and physically remove idols, like actual idols from her house, and help her walk through that. There's a great book that I would recommend called Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. It's by Rosaria Butterfield. Have you heard of Rosaria Butterfield? Yeah, so she's local. She's in Durham. She helped train our launch team, but she was in a... she was a practicing lesbian for years of her life and then came hardcore face-to-face with the gospel and devoted her life to Jesus. A beautiful change. She's married to a Presbyterian minister now and has kids and stuff, but highly recommend that. There's a girl. Yes. Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert, Rosaria Butterfield. Spelled exactly like it sounds. Rosaria Butterfield. There's a girl... at the current church that I work at, it's celebrating its 25th anniversary, but around 5-year mark, they had grown and they had an office and stuff. And so one of the members there had a daughter who was an adult dancer. She was a stripper. And she was a single mom with a really bad cocaine addiction. And so she's tried to get in other jobs and couldn't get in other jobs because they just didn't pay as well. And she had a drug habit and all this sort of stuff. So it was just too easy to fall back into that lifestyle. So the girl's dad came to our pastor and said, I know this is crazy, but can she like help clean or something? Can we just like pay her a living wage so she can get out of this lifestyle? So the pastor's like, sure, I guess I'll interview her. So her name is, we'll call her Samantha. So Samantha comes in for the interview, and she just got done smoking a joint in the car before the interview at the evangelical church. So she walks in. You can just smell it on her. The pastor interviews her and was like, okay, you got the job. You're going to be our front desk lady. So you're going to answer calls and greet everyone. She's like, really? He's like, yes. Don't wear what you're wearing tomorrow, and don't come high. Just don't come to church high. We don't care what you do in your spare time. But so we hired her. So then she's hanging out with Christians all the time. She's not dancing anymore. We got to love on her and stuff. She started to go to Bible studies, and she would bring her friends that danced with her. And they were, it was this older ladies group, and they were so precious. But Samantha would go in to the group, and they'd be learning and stuff. And every time something cool would come out, she'd be like, bleep, 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 that's amazing. Like, she'd just cuss, be like, that's bleeping amazing. I never knew God was like that. And these ladies just walked by her side by side, and she got saved after about a year and a half of working at the church. And to this day, yesterday I sat beside her. So she's in charge of all the admins and runs safety and security. Joseph right there, you know who I'm talking about. It's not Samantha, but you know. And if you look at her life now, you're like, yeah, she's not as like far along as like she should be for being saved for 20 years, but she loves Jesus more than anyone I've known, and she's taken 247 steps towards Jesus, and I've probably taken like 11 in my entire life, you know? So those are the type of people that we need to really pour into and love. The people in your city that don't know Jesus really don't know Jesus. They didn't grow up in grandma's church. They've never heard the gospel. They've never been to an evangelical church. But they're curious, and they do want to believe. And so we need to make the gospel available to them, and we need to be willing to walk beside them even if it's a little bit more complicated. So, all right. And then lastly, I would say this, be the place where people go when the wheels fall off. Be the type of church where people can turn to when the wheels fall off. And I didn't realize how important or how fruitful this type of thing was. I think it's actually a very overlooked area of ministry and one that's going to be more and more prominent in the coming years. But people, they're anxious, they're depressed. Consumerism and a new car and a new house every other year is not filling that void. Marriages are slowly starting to fall apart. Kids are getting harder and harder to raise. And so these people are going to slowly begin reaching out more and more to the local church. They need marriage counseling. They need help as a single mom to keep the electricity on. They need a food pantry. They need a warm coat for the winter, that sort of stuff. And so I think evangelistic crusades will reach less people than they used to. But you know what? Ministries are probably going to reach more people in the coming years. It's going to be benevolence. It's going to be counseling. And it's going to be like marriage ministries. I just came back to our church. And one of the most fruitful ministries we have is the marriage ministry. Because two people will come in and be like, we think we're Christians or we grew up Catholic. We've been coming for a few weeks, but our marriage is horrible. And Dave, our marriage pastor, he probably leads, I don't know, 3 or 4 people to Jesus every single week that come in for marriage. We have a marriage class, okay? These are people that are taking a re-engage class is what we call it. It's an 8-week class on marriage. 70% of people, 70% of the engaged couples are already sleeping together, and 78% of those couples are already living together, which means 8% are lying. But 80% of people are living together and sleeping together, and 100% of them would say that they are Christians or they are spiritual, right? These are people that don't know Jesus from a lizard. They look for help, and they found a church that is willing to help them out, and they get to hear the gospel. They get to realize it's okay to be broken, and we're seeing salvations result left and right. So I would say what we're going to see in the church in this new secular age is counseling ministries and marriage ministries and even counselors for like 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds. That's going to be a huge place of fruit that we see. So those are the three things I would say, and I want to leave time for questions. We have until 1:45, so we actually have probably 15 or 20 minutes for questions, but I would say this, okay? I'm going to leave here after this breakout. I'm going to get some gas and put it in my truck, and I can probably walk in and get a Cheerwine or a Sun Drop, okay? So this is not New York or Canada. So we're still in the South. We're still in the Bible Belt, so we're not going to be like a Berkeley overnight, I would say that we still serve a God who came into this world to save sinners, right? That is a true statement. Christ Jesus came to save sinners. The grave is empty, and the gospel still is the power of God. So I had a guy in my church that was homeless for 2 years, and he heard a street preacher, probably not getting the gospel exactly correct, and he accepted Jesus and put his life accepted salvation in Jesus and devoted his life to him. I've had numerous people come up and say, someone knocked on my door and gave me a lady that works at our staff right now. That's Joseph. He works with me as a pastor. She got saved because someone put a track down with a tip at a restaurant. So God's going to save people. The gospel still is the power. I wouldn't give up hope. We're experiencing a decline in spirituality and church attendance in the U.S., but everywhere else in the world, in the Southern Hemisphere, every non-white Western country, there's a resurgence of spirituality. The world is actually getting less secular, it's expected to continue to get more and more religious and more Christian as the years go by. So there's hope here. Don't like go hide in a hole and try to read all these books and I have to get it right. Just speak the name of Jesus and make the gospel available and God will do cool stuff. So, all right, any questions? Yes.
All that you've been saying, and I've been hearing as it relates to those more than a few years younger than I am, what about the multiple generation event of where your church is trying to reach 4 to 5 generations? What about the upper half? How many of those fit into this, or do we are feeling like, because my son said, Dad, don't worry, push the button, it won't blow up. The 55 and older, are they still hanging on to a world that no longer exists? And what you're describing is strictly for those who recognize this ancient realm.
Yeah, well, Taylor wrote this. Obviously, he's based in Canada, which is a bit more secular, a lot more secular than the U.S., but this book came out 10 years ago. And Taylor himself is in his, I guess, mid-60s, maybe even his 70s. So the book is not painted as a generational thing. In fact, you know, I think a lot of books are written on Generation Y and Generation X and boomers and all that sort of stuff, and there's probably too much stock put into it. It's like, you guys might like kick me out of here, but like the five love languages, like that's, it's not biblical, but probably something good to think about. But like we put a lot of stock in the five love languages or a lot of stock in the millennials. So I don't think that Taylor's speaking necessarily to a generation. I think that because of consumerism and technology and globalism, this sort of, like I watch Netflix, like my generation binges on Netflix, but my grandparents love Wheel of Fortune and NCIS, and they have the same TV watching thing. They're just okay with commercials, you know? So we exhibit the same sort of habits where I'll go online and look for a new pair of jeans or the next new cell phone, but my grandmother buys like 60 different bushes for her yard every year, and she's at Home Depot like every other half hour, right? So we still exhibit the same action. So I would say it's not necessarily generational, but there obviously will be some differences. I think the older generation responds better to logic and carefully thought out sort of stuff, whereas the younger generation, it's all based on feeling, and they haven't thought through a lot of this stuff. So you have a 60-year-old atheist, I mean, prepare to have some long conversations because he's thought through this. Like, he's established how I can get morality and how I can get things like love and truth and beauty without, like, he's thought through these issues. Where most college kids nowadays are like, they haven't put any thought into it whatsoever. And there, it's more of a feeling, and it's a different sort of conversation. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah, I think what they experienced in Ireland, that's a conservative form of Christianity, which is good. So, I mean, we don't want to give or budge on any of Orthodox Christianity. I think what we are seeing now is for far too long, the church has been known for what we are against. This is what you don't do. This is bad, bad, bad. But we haven't given them a clear picture of what we're for. So we've said, yeah, homosexuality or sex outside of marriage is bad. But we haven't given them a clear picture of, but God made male and female to portray different characteristics of the Godhead. And when they come together, there's a unity and there's a distinction. And there's a mutual glorifying of that God. There's a sacrifice. There's a love. There's an encouragement. There's a covenant. There's a commitment. It's a living, breathing parable of Christ's love for the church. It fills up the need that we have for significance and wholeness and all this sort of stuff. Like, we haven't given them a beautiful picture of sexuality and marriage and what that is for. Instead, we said, you can't do that. But now what we're seeing, there's lots more churches and lots more thinkers that are offering a holistic picture of that. So I'm thinking of livingout.org in the U.S., I mean, in the U.K. These are same-sex attracted ministers in the U.K. that have chosen a life of celibacy and singleness and a way to honor God, and I'm not going to get married. And I'll admit, yes, I'm attracted to the same sex, but I'm going to obey what the Bible says about it, and I can still live holistically. And I can still have a full life. So I think what we're going to see is a Christianity that's more robust. Actually, Taylor says that he's not even upset that any of this happens. We can't go back to the way things were. We're never going to be a Christian nation again. We will just be a re-Christianized nation, but we can't get back to the way things were. And actually, this sort of secularity is really good for the church. Underneath Constantine, you know, everyone was a Christian, but no one actually practiced it. And a lot of fake Christians. So it has a purifying effect on the church. It's pushing Christianity to the sidelines, the peripherals of society. And that's where God usually does his best work, is from the sidelines of Christianity. We are in no way. I just actually saw a friend who, or talked to a friend, does ministry in like Southeast Asia and stuff where persecution's a real thing. So the small level of persecution the church is feeling is actually good. God uses that. So I think what we're going to find, if I had to guess, is a more robust Christianity that offers a lot more yeses instead of noes. A purified church where you a lot of people are going to leave because we're not going to give up on morality and all these issues. And probably a Christianity that's able to influence the culture more than it has been in the past. So I mean, it's God's church. There's two things that are going to last for eternity. It's his word and his church. So I have no fears about it, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
We need churches. One of the big questions is, well, what about church membership? You know, how does kind of like the secular age and morality, as that pushes up to church membership, wisely doing church discipline, all those things. So, you know, as you guys were delving into all of that, what did that look like?
Yeah. Yes, that's the sharp contrast I'm seeing, and the difference between Asheville and suburbia. Where I'm ministering now, we don't draw a sharp difference between members and non-members. And it seems to be beneficial to see salvations that way. In Asheville, practically, okay, in Asheville, because we have lots of people checking it out, we went back to a more liturgical service, so they could see that this was tied to something ancient and not just a passing fad. We began to do communion every week, and we fenced the table. So every single week we'd say, hey, this is the one part of the service that if you're not a Christ follower, if you wouldn't profess to be a follower of Jesus, we're going to ask you to sit this out. And this is because this is an outward sign of an inward reality, but just because you can't have the symbol, you can have the real thing. And we'd explain the gospel. And some of the most beneficial conversations actually came out of, I was really offended that he wouldn't let me take communion, but it made me think, I don't profess to be a Christ follower. So they had these at least help define where people are. So yeah, I think it just worked in that context. Now, I think that the practical issues are the secondary, tertiary, open-handed issues. But yeah, you'd have to figure out what works best in your context. We did a sharp line between membership. We had member meetings every month, and if you weren't a member, you weren't allowed to come. We'd actually ask you to leave. So you'd come up, you'd be like, you're not a member. We're going to ask you to leave because we take this covenant together so seriously. But now at a church that does almost the opposite, but also sees lots of salvations. So, yeah. So I've been in both churches. That's what I'm learning, man. Like after planting a church, I was passionate about like 28 things when I planted a church. And now I'm like, if you preach the gospel, I like your church. Like I'm good with it. So hopefully this was helpful. If nothing else, you got the lists of some pretty good books. So we'll call it a win at that. But let me pray. Father, you are sovereign. You set forth a plan in Genesis 3 to make everything right that is wrong in this broken world. And that plan will absolutely come to fulfillment. And no technology and no cultural change will ever stop that from going forth. It's your desire that none should perish. And people from every tribe, nation, and tongue will be before your throne. And cities of ruthless men will bow their knees and call you blessed. And so give us courage, as the church in Acts prayed, and boldness. Let us not shrink. This is just a different situation, but it's no less harder or easier than it's ever been. And your gospel is no less strong than it has always been. And so let us rely on the gospel. Let us speak it often. I pray that even us here, we won't see that find your one video and think, okay, that's just the yearly thing that we're going through. I really do pray that we would have people in our lives that we're trying to bring to salvation in Jesus, and that we would become practitioners of this, not just studiers of this. So we pray that you would just become famous and draw thousands of people this year into your kingdom in the state of North Carolina and all over the world. And it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.